So what would you want your first investigations to be?
If the index of suspicion is very high, I would recommend proceed straight to the ultrasound for two reasons. One, ultrasound is very diagnostic of intussusception because you can see a bull's eye or a target sign. And secondly, ultrasound will rule out other conditions which can mimic the pain of intussusception, such as ovarian pathology, appendicitis, and other things. So ultrasound not only helps in confirming the diagnosis, but it also helps in ruling out a lot of other diagnoses. It is non-invasive, it is radiation-free, and it straightway leads to the diagnosis.
Great, and just, I've been asked this before, so just to help anyone else out who gets asked this in the middle of a ward round, how many circles do you see on the target lesion?
You classically see three circles.
So you've diagnosed, so you've seen the target lesion. What would you want your next steps to be?
Yeah, so once you have seen the target lesion, then you ask yourself only two questions. One is this child peritonitic? In other words, is the child in shock or has got peritoneal signs? If that is the case, then this child goes to the operating theater straight away. If none of those signs are there, then the child goes for the radiological reduction. And the preparation for the radiological reduction is the first thing is that you inform the operating theater that you are carrying out the procedure. The reason being that if the radiological reduction fails, or God forbids, if there is any perforation during the radiological procedure, then you need an urgent operating theater. So that is one thing. Second is secure a good intravenous access. And thirdly, if your hospital believes or does the pneumatic reduction, then you must carry a good 18 gauge Venflon in your pocket, because if there is a tension pneumoperitoneum, that is the something which will come handy in those cases.
Okay. We do pneumatic reduction in Nottingham. So you're able to talk us through what we do for that?
Yeah, with the pneumatic reduction, you know, you have a child who's got a safe intravenous access. Some centers give antibiotics and some centers don't give antibiotics, and I have no, you know, preference for that. Pneumatic reduction is, compared to hydrostatic, it is much more simpler, less messy. And if there is a perforation, there is less contamination. So what you do is you pass a balloon catheter into the rectum. You strap the buttocks together so there is no air leak. You inflate the balloon and then you push the air, making sure that it never goes above the pressure of 120 millimeter of mercury. Rather, aim to keep it around 100 millimeter of mercury. And what you see is the air will go into the colon, which will be to begin with descending colon, then transverse colon, then there may be stoppage because of intussusception, and then you can see that the intussusception keeps on moving back slowly, and you only stop reduction once there is a free flow of air into the terminal ileum. But one of the things to remember is that when we used to do the hydrostatic reductions, we used to teach the juniors and the faculty that the only way to prove that intussusception is reduced is a free flow of dye into the terminal ileum. Whereas with pneumatic reduction, you may get a free flow of air into the terminal ileum and still the intussusception may not be completely reduced. So you be aware of this pitfall. The other thing you have to remember is that if there is a perforation during the pneumatic reduction, you create a condition called tension pneumoperitoneum, because we are injecting air at 100 millimeter plus of pressure, and if there is a hole in the intestine, suddenly there is a lot of leakage of air into the peritoneum, and that can tent the diaphragm and compromise the respiration, and that is when the injection of a needle in the supraumbilical midline region to decompress the air comes handy.
Yeah, there's obviously also the problem of fecal contamination as well, so they're going to need to go to theatre.
Yes.
Ultimately, aren't they? Well, I understand that you can do a hydrostatic reduction as well. Can you talk us through what are some of the pros and cons comparing pneumatic to hydrostatic reduction?
Yeah, some centers are not comfortable with doing with the pneumatic and they stick to the hydrostatic, but only thing I would caution is that do not use barium for the hydrostatic reduction, because if there is peritonitis, it is called barium peritonitis, which is very difficult to treat. So you use water soluble medium, And in hydrostatic reduction, usually there is a rule of three. You apply pressure for 3 minutes and you wait for 3 minutes, and then in between, when you're applying the pressure, your height of the chamber should not be more than 3 feet above the patient. So this is called the rule of three. Now, the disadvantage with the hydrostatic reduction is that it involves more radiation compared to the pneumatic. It can be messy, especially if there is a perforation on the operating table, because the contamination is much, much more, and you know, the fecal matter is distributed with the fluid all over the peritoneal cavity as compared to the pneumatic reduction. And thirdly, the success rate in various series with the hydrostatic reduction is a little bit less compared to the pneumatic reduction. Hydrostatic reduction can be done both either by a radiological guidance or by ultrasound guiding, depending upon your experience, but most of the centers do it with the radiological fluoroscopic guidance.
So I understand that quite a few of these patients can have a recurrence following the reduction. So how should we go about managing these?
Recurrence is more common than we think, and it is more common after hydrostatic and pneumatic reduction as compared to open surgery, where you do a laparotomy, reduce the interception, and especially if you have done appendectomy, then the chances of recurrence are low. So the thing to remember is a high index of suspicion. So you monitor the child and you warn the family about the signs and symptoms to look for the recurrent intussusception. Because we usually warn them enough, most of these intussusception are picked up within the first 24 to 48 hours. And as the time passes, the chances of recurrence goes down. The other thing which you have to remember is that when you get recurrent intussusception, always think, could there be a lead point, or could it be a pathological lead point leading to intussusception?
Okay. And these are probably the patients, the ones with the lead point, that are more likely to need surgery, just like the patients with peritonitis. Is that right?
It depends. If you get recurrence after a straightforward pneumatic or hydrostatic reduction, and the child had fulfilled all the criteria of radiological reduction, in other words, the child was not peritonitic, you can always give another trial of pneumatic or hydrostatic reduction. However, if you get a recurrent intussusception after a laparotomy or laparoscopy, then those are the kids which needs an operative procedure to address the recurrence rather than a pneumatic reduction or hydrostatic reduction.
Okay. As we've alluded to a couple of times already, a small minority may need surgery. So can you talk us through the surgical approach, please?
Yeah. The main indications for surgery are if you have a child which presents de novo with peritonitis and intussusception. Those are the ones where you do not do radiological reduction. And the second indication for surgery is where you have tried a hydrostatic or a pneumatic reduction and it has failed. In other words, the intussusception is stuck, and it could be from various reasons, be it a pathological lead point or be it a dead or dying intestine. And the third indication for surgery is that if you create a perforation at the time of radiological reduction, then you obviously need a surgery. And the fourth very rare indication is that if on the ultrasound you have a very high suspicion of a pathological lead point, then of course you do surgery. Now, coming to surgery, you have a choice of laparoscopy versus open surgery. And there are some centers which do laparoscopy for the diagnosis, confirmation of intussusception followed by laparotomy, but there are other centers who are capable of doing the reduction of the intussusception totally by laparoscopic approach. Now, the only difference between the laparoscopic and open approach is that in open approach, we teach our students that do not pull the intussusception. You just keep on compressing the lead point and keep on reducing it. Whereas in laparoscopy, you pull the intussusception also, as well as compressing it with the Johann's forceps. So if you can reduce it laparoscopically, fine, but if you don't have experience, then most of the centers, they will do an open surgery. The incision is classical, right upper transverse incision above the umbilicus. You deliver the intussusception, you pack the ball with warm saline gauze, and you should be very gentle but very consistent, and keep on compressing and pushing the tip of the intussusception. And you may make some serosal tears in that, but do not put too much pressure at too quick an interval. So be consistent, be gentle, and be patient, and it keeps on reducing. And if you can't reduce it, then you have to do a resection.
Mm-hmm. So that about caps us off there. So is there anything else that you'd like to talk about just with intussusception?
Only thing I would say is that once you have completely reduced the intussusception, and if you think that the bowel wall is compromised, wait for 10 minutes before taking any decision. During the 10 minutes, you can request the anesthetist to give 100% oxygen, apply warm caps, and see that. But if there is any doubt about the viability of the bowel, it is best to resect it rather than risk another perforation in the postoperative period. Second thing is the serosal tears. Do not take them lightly. If they are big and massive, then they should need some repair or invagination. But if they are small, then they can be left. But again, be aware of that. And second thing is, once you have reduced the intussusception, always look for the lead point. And that is one of the advantage which the open surgery has over the laparoscopy, because in laparoscopy, you don't have the tactile sensation to look for the lead point.
Mm-hmm. So just to recap, what would be your three main take-home points for everyone?
Yeah, my main three take-home points is that if you are given a history of a child between the age of 3 months to 3 years who intermittently cries and pulls his both legs to the abdomen, and then he is fine in between those episodes, do not put it down to any ordinary abdominal colic, because this could be the first suggestive symptom of intussusception. In other words, do not ignore a crying child who pulls his both knees up intermittently. So that's my first carry home message. The second thing is that in the Western world, there are very few causes for a red currant jelly stools. If you were in developing world, I would say you can think about dysentery, you can think about typhoid and other things. But in this part of the world, if a child between the 3 months to 3 years passes a red currant jelly stools, it's not a medical gastroenteritis. It is intussusception unless proved otherwise. And the third is a good abdominal examination with a relaxed child. And if you can feel a sausage-shaped lump, or you can have a dance signs where there's emptiness on the right aleic fossa. And thirdly, this is one thing where I would recommend you do a rectal exam. And if your finger has a red currant jelly stool when you do the rectal exam, this is intussusception unless proved otherwise.
Brilliant. Thank you very much for your time. So if anyone has any further questions on this topic, then fear not. We've attached a PDF that can be downloaded in the show notes. This PDF is a photocopy of Mr. Singh's notes, which he has lovingly put together. They're a work of art and cover everything we've gone through today and then a little bit more. So in summary, thank you for tuning in and have a great day.
Thank you for listening to another podcast brought to you by School of Surgery. Remember, you can follow us on Facebook at School of Surgery, on iTunes, on Podomatic at schoolofsurgery.podomatic.com, and finally by searching School of Surgery on YouTube. Thank you very much, and see you next time.